Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 26, 2000. In the fireside room this evening, Dan Mishkin and Karen Ogle present session number 2009, titled Jewish and Christian Connections, Faith, Promise, and Covenant, God Wrestling, Speaking Truth to Power When the Power is God. Let's listen in.
For those of you who haven't been with us before, I'm Dan Mishkin from East Lansing, Michigan. My wife, Karen Ogle, is actually in the room up on the balcony level, the seraphim level. Some of you have seen Karen in her neck collar, and that's from an accident and things that have sort of been in sequence from that. And this seemed like a good time for her to maybe take it easy on that, be up there to heckle as necessary. She said she'd be willing to do that, which is really nice. In Yiddish, the word is kibitz. Right? If you have the word kibitz, that's to sort of be perfectly willing to throw in your two cents whenever. It's kind of look over your shoulder and just say, no, do it that way. So, this session is about God wrestling. And part of it is going to be about looking at a Jewish view of our relationship with God that grows out of the biblical text about how characters in the Bible have related to God. I think as we go along, one thing that will be interesting to hear is how you maybe have traditionally looked at some of the same texts and stories, and what interpretations you're more familiar with, and see where they might actually merge, where they maybe just don't quite fit together at all, and see what that means. So you've probably heard this phrase, speaking truth to power. It's certainly something that's familiar from many characters in the Bible who, because of the inspiration of God, will speak to kings and to others, as Moses spoke to Pharaoh, as Joseph spoke to Pharaoh, as Daniel spoke to Nebuchadnezzar, as the prophets spoke to even the powerful leaders of the kingdom of Judah when they felt that the people of Israel were going astray. And I think it's fair to say, as in the New Testament portrayal, as Jesus does to the powers of his day. We're certainly familiar with that kind of speaking truth to power. Then the martyrs for religion in later history, and maybe sometimes yes and sometimes not, faith-inspired speaking truth to power that we find in the in liberation movements of the 20th century, in the civil rights movement, and other places where you say, you may be the powerful one, but you are not right. Okay? So the interesting thing that happens in the Hebrew Bible is that some of the characters who are saying that are saying it to God. And one of our first examples of that is Abraham. So you remember the story of Sodom. And what happens when God decides he's going to destroy Sodom? He's just made his covenant with Abraham, said, get up and go from your native land. I will make you a blessing, and the people of the earth shall bless themselves through you. And God says to God's self, well, I'm going to destroy Sodom, but I really can't do this without talking to Abraham first. And this is really almost literally what the text tells us. And famously, when Abraham hears this, he says, he's appalled, basically. But Abraham thinks that the destruction of an entire city, if it results in the deaths of innocents, is not just in any way. And he says, He says, shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly? That's Abraham challenging God. You are the God of justice. Act justly. That's pretty. Another Hebrew word, okay? That shows a small amount of chutzpah. Okay? But that's what he says. Now, we then have challengers to God's authority who are maybe not quite the righteous men that Abraham is. In fact, some of them are downright offensive as individuals. The one who has the least reason to challenge God, but does anyway, is Jonah. But Jonah is a great story. Why does Jonah challenge God? Anybody have the answer?
He doesn't like people.
Right. And what is he afraid is going to happen if he preaches?
God's going to repent. Yeah.
That they're going to repent, and God, in God's mercy, will allow them to live. And this bothers Jonah no end. He's really an awful character, but a sort of a delightful awful character. So who are some of the other God wrestlers? Well, who is kind of the quintessential God wrestler, whose name means wrestle with God?
Jacob,
right. His name becomes Yisrael, Israel, the one who wrestles with God. And Jacob is also, he's a conniver. He steals his brother's birthright. He steals the blessing from his blind father. Arguable, I do this with my kids in Hebrew school, we argue about whether or not Abraham really knew that. I'm sorry, Isaac, thank you. It's always nice to have kibitz going on. whether Isaac really knew who he was blessing. But be that as it may, Jacob, with the help of his mother, was prepared to just steal the birthright and the blessing. And he's not a great guy. And what's about to happen when he wrestles with the angel? What's going to be, or the man? It says man in the text. Whether it's God, angel, man, who knows? What is supposed to happen the next day?
Is he going to meet his brother?
He's going to meet his brother after all that time with living and working for his uncle Laban, for the hand of what turns out to be two wives. He is going to meet with Esau again, and he is scared out of his wits. And somehow, wrestling with God resolves the fear for him. I mean, isn't that fascinating? He wrestles with God, and then he's able to confront the brother that he cheated and have a reunion that brings them more or less together. It's a fascinating thing to think about, that you have to wrestle with God before you can finish wrestling with your brother. It's really amazing to me. It's as the middle of three brothers, we don't need to go anywhere else. But, you know, and then he gives his name to the people Israel. Am Yisrael, the people Israel. And we are all God wrestlers. That's sort of our legacy from Jacob, is to find the right path, not simply by God said it, I believe it, but by wrestling with God, by wrestling with what God said. One of the really interesting things about these stories to me is that the ones that we interpret so negatively sometimes are really, in my view, are telling us how good it is to wrestle and even to rebel. I mean, there are not just debaters, not moralists, not self-righteous people like Jonah, but they're actual rebels. I mean, where's the first rebellion? in the Garden of Eden, right? And followed immediately by the first murder. These are not traditionally seen as wonderful events, you know? But there's a peculiar Jewish understanding. Not every single Jew, you know, I'm speaking partly for myself, partly from what I read. I'm not speaking for the, you know, the Hasidic rabbi in Brooklyn who probably has a different point of view. But there's a Jewish point of view that says, isn't it good that rebellion happened? I had a discussion with Larry Rasmussen, who was teaching here last week, and a very interesting discussion that he was leading about a sort of creation-filled faith, where we honor the earth in ways that our religion has sometimes separated us, abstracted us from the real world that we live in. And he said, you know, in the garden, when Adam fell, he lost some of his humanity because he separated from paradise. And now we're outside the garden needing to regain the humanity that Adam lost. And I said, well, you know, it's funny you should say that, because I actually see it completely differently. I see Adam and Eve in the garden as not yet fully human. They're childlike in their innocence, in that lack of knowledge. Does any of us want to be so innocent that we don't know good and evil? That we don't have that ability to choose? With the ability to choose comes sometimes rebellion, and out of rebellion, the ability to choose to go back to God as adults. And this is a pretty different perspective on rebellion than most of us, I think, Jews and Christians, were raised with. It's rebelling against God, bad. You know, oh, they left the garden, bad. But, you know, maybe it's my limited human outside of the garden sensibility, but I don't want to be what Adam and Eve were. I want to be fully human and fully able to choose and find a way back that allows me to be me, allows me to be human when I go back to God, and allows me to say, God, I don't always agree, you know, which may happen. I mean, have any of you had experiences with these stories where you with the story of the garden? What was the story of the Garden of Eden for you? Was it, yes?
I have to say my interpretation, the one that I felt most comfortable with, is exactly that.
Uh-huh.
I really feel that the Adam and Eve story is more of a coming of age, as we were talking about last time, that archetype repeated again for all of mankind.
Right.
And it's the full humanization of our experience.
Yeah.
I was going to say, another way that I've heard it is that it's really a step towards consciousness, being able to determine, becoming mature to determine good and evil.
Right. Mitch.
I've always sort of loved that, you know, the Jewish tradition of not only, like you say, arguing with God, defying God, and the thing that really strikes me in the relationship between Jesus and the apostles is how Jewish that really is. You know, it's like, you know, through a lot of the Bible, Jesus is leading these guys, and a lot of them sound kind of like chuckleheads. There's some direct parallels, and I don't know if they're written to be intentionally written to be a parallel. For example, the story of the apostles and Jesus rowing across the lake.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to go. They're going to preach on the other side of the lake, and they don't want to go. They're afraid to go, and Jesus has to make them go against their will, and I think there's some direct parallels. And all through the relationship, the apostles are arguing with him, trying to urge him to do things that he doesn't want to do, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think one of the things is that a majority of thought, and I think from St. Augustine on, has a tendency to focus in on original sin. Mm-hmm. And though there is another tradition around original blessing, and I think that that was even more heightened with some of the work by Teilhard de Chardin and others in this century, that have really taken the perspective that you're sharing and saying, that was such a critical moment in human development. Because without it, you can't have covenant.
Right.
You know, right. So it's you can't have Jesus. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. So whatever tradition you come at, you can't have Torah and you can't have Jesus.
Right.
If that doesn't take place. And so there's a piece to this that I think is really important.
Yeah.
To acknowledge.
I think that's true. I think the idea of original blessing and original sin, you know, that really, we see that. I set before you this day the blessing and the curse in Deuteronomy. The choice is present in our lives, and denying the choice is really, I think, trying to fit us as human beings into a model that doesn't really exist in the real world. At my point of view, anyway. Did I see a hand up on this side? I wasn't sure.
Just a little piece. Reading the story in the garden, I agree with the notion that it's a step in, it's a development of a level of consciousness for humanity, because it seemed like a setup. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, here's the tree, what's the tree gonna do? The situation is designed to force humanity to make that jump.
Right. Yeah, you know, it's almost like this is what God is asking us to do, just like God asked Abraham to challenge God on the subject of the destruction of Sodom, as God says to Moses after the golden calf incident, and they're both pretty steamed, okay, Moses and God, but God says, you know, I'm going to wipe out this people. They've just been awful. I'm going to wipe this people out. And he says something along the lines of, now don't you try to stop me, Moses. And, you know, and the signal is there. And it's actually Moses is very good. He gets all this cajoling and all of this, you know, sort of stroking and at the same time appealing to a sense of mercy and all of these things. You know, you don't want those Egyptians to say that you led the Israelites out of Egypt only to kill them all. I mean, how's that going to look on your permanent record? this is the kind of dialogue that we have going on with some of these characters. And God, where, like you say, God is sort of asking to be challenged. I read a fascinating article by Rabbi Arthur Wasko, who's really the coiner of the term God wrestling as an understanding of our relationship with God. And he was writing about the Cain and Abel story. And he said, and I guess I referred briefly to this in our session yesterday, that God says to Cain, after God rejects Cain's blessing and Cain's face falls, he says to Cain, well, Cain, what's up? You got something to say? And Cain doesn't say anything. Cain doesn't take up the challenge to wrestle with God. And because he doesn't, the only other outlet he can find is to kill his brother. So now there's an interesting set of choices. Wrestle with me or live violent, unfulfilling lives on earth. You know, that's a really interesting way of looking at that story. So that wrestling thing and the idea of rebellion. Another story about Moses is the way Moses tries to get out of the call at the burning bush. You know, you've got the wrong guy. It's really, I don't speak very well. I, you know, they're not going to believe me when I go back to Egypt, and all of these things. And he's ready. He knows who he's speaking to. There's no, but he's ready to say to get out of it if he can. He's not the willing prophet by any means. You have a question or comment?
Well, I do. I just maybe your thoughts on this, that, you know, for those of us now, you know, we have had Jesus, and so we have the grace of, you know, his death and resurrection. So when we kind of have these wrestling matches that we think are that with God, and going through all that, we still know we have God's grace and mercy through Jesus.
Right.
You have these people in the Old Testament who didn't have that. So to me, it would have been even more fearful and scary to have that kind of a thing, because there's not that same...
I'm not sure if I'd say that the people of the Hebrew Bible would perceive themselves as not having God's grace. I mean, God's grace is present. The word chen, meaning grace, is there. There's a, after the golden calf incident, when Moses goes up for the second set of tablets, and God shows God's own self to Moses in a way that no other recording, in any recorded place, no other has had that sort of intimate view of it. Not God's face, because that would be too much, but he sees the receiving God. And he says something that is actually part of the liturgy on Yom Kippur, the Jewish Day of Atonement. It's Adonai El Rachum V'Chanun, Chen V'Chesed V'Rachamim. It's God, I'd like to translate quickly now. It's sort of full of mercy and grace and loving kindness, and all those terms. It's actually 13 merciful attributes of God, and that's right in there in the Book of Exodus. So I think that the way we construct the idea of grace is probably going to be different, but there's a sense of God's grace and God's redemption, redemptive power that's really present. In fact, in a way, it's amazing that these people are so incredibly fickle and complaining. You know, imagine this. You've just seen God part the sea. And you say, we don't have anything to eat out here. That's your first response. I mean, what could this be? I did a talk every Shabbat morning, Saturday morning. Somebody talks about the part of the Torah that's read that day. And I chose that Torah portion. And I wanted to find a modern equivalent to the story of the complaining Israelites. And I realized, you know, it's kind of like me and my computer. It doesn't matter how much more power, how much more RAM, you know, how big a hard drive, how fast the computer is, I want more! and you know, there's that kind of relationship with God. But it's amazing that they in a way, that they could be so ungrateful, it seems like.
And it's funny in the Haggadah, when they do the Dayanim, and, you know, where they say, it would have been enough if you had only done this. You kind of go, this isn't very biblical.
That's true. And we actually sang this song in our session the other day, and it's funny because we didn't act that way in the desert. We didn't act as though, you know, any piece of it would have been justifying us. Did you have your hand up?
Well, it was just kind of a commentary that I was thinking. We kept, I don't even know if it's appropriate to ask, but I always ask questions.
Sure.
We were talking about how the human relationship to God has continued to kind of, we hope, kind of grow and mature, and we can have, need to have this wrestling to grow to a different level of relationship. And yet when I look at, of course I'm also looking from kind of New Testament to Old Testament eyes, it seems like God has changed and grown and matured, because at least in the writings that we have in the relationship with people, from being, you know, fairly, in my mind, looking back, kind of harsh. I mean, when I think of the Noah story, boy, that's pretty harsh.
Yeah, right.
You know, so I just maybe wonder if he, obviously he needs the relationship with us, maybe to help stimulate, maybe it's reciprocal. It seems like it's just
I think that's a good sort of Torah yeshiva student exegesis of text, you know, that there's a growing God, and that it's because of God's relationship with us as humans that growth occurs.
Okay.
trying to think of the author's name, and it escapes me. He's a Jesuit. He wrote God, a biography. And he says exactly the same thing. He suggests a little different order for reading the books of the Bible. But he says, God, this is the first time God ever created the world. First time he ever had anything to do with anybody. Yeah. And so he changes just as, and he said, well, the reason it's such a wonderful biography is that God changes, that the central character grows and changes. And I think that's wonderful. My son-in-law was horrified when I suggested this to him. He will not read the book. But it's
Missouri City Lutheran like.
But he says he takes just the words of God in the Old Testament. And he says the last time God speaks is after his debate with Job. And then Job gets the last word, and God never speaks again. From then on, the prophets will tell you what God has said to them, and they will report. But that was an interesting...
That's very interesting. It's helpful because I'm thinking on Yom Kippur, Jonah is the reading for the afternoon service. And it occurred to me just recently that I might want to take on the job of doing the commentary and compare Jonah and Job, because I think that Jonah comes off pretty well for a thoroughly unlikable person. And Job is, maybe Job should have been more like Jonah. You know, it's kind of what I'm thinking. So it would be interesting to sort of look at the point that you're raising, or your son-in-law is raising.
He just says God never changes.
Yeah, well, I got to tell you, I think that's a tough reading of the text, to say that God never changes. But, you know.
It's a Hellenistic reading.
Yeah.
Well, the fact that God repents more than the Israelites do, I mean, is absolutely clear. I mean, he's constantly repenting. I mean, the language is repenting.
Yeah, right.
God changes God's heart.
Yeah. And that Jonah exchange is really a perfect example of that. And also in the Jonah story, when the sailors have to throw him overboard, they know, and Jonah admits, you know, I'm the reason, you know, and they throw him over, and they're not Jews, they're Gentiles, and they get down on their knees and praise Jonah's God. The stories of the Gentiles who turn to God in the Bible are really terrific. Sometimes they're such interesting characters, and they're so much more, I don't know, likable, so much more. They give you so much. Another Yiddish word. They give you such nachas, but joy. You know, they really, you know, fulfillment, because they at least can behave in ways that the Israelites seem not to be able to quite handle. I saw some other hands up over here. Yeah, Bill.
Well, I was just maybe going to argue a pinch about, well, probably more than a pinch about creation thing. Yeah, I think all these other examples are examples of encountering God or wrestling, the Jacob story, which really kind of demand a certain amount of trust and faith, and that God's not going to squash you.
Right.
But it seems to me that the Genesis 3 story is more of an avoidance of God, and actually is not an encounter with God at all. It's a different, wholly different kind of.
Well, it's a rebellion. Yeah. It's a rebellion where they don't engage God. You're right.
There ain't no trust there.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. You said when my oldest daughter, Karen's, and my oldest daughter did her discussion of the Torah text for her bat mitzvah. That was the opening reading from Genesis, and we worked on what can you say about this. What she came to was this idea: how could they possibly trust God? They just met him, you know. And so it's the trust issue is kind of an interesting one there. And I think it's probably a rebellion of a different sort, because it, in a weird way, establishes the relationship that others will be able to use more effectively.
Well, I think they could have challenged God face to face.
Right. But maybe our daughter Grace is right that they didn't have, God hadn't built up the trust, or they hadn't built up the trust or something to allow them to do it. But I think it's a good reading to say that they could have done that, just as similar to Wasco's reading of Cain, that Cain could have challenged God, but didn't, but shied away, but said, I don't know what happened to my brother. Yeah.
But I think the idea of the evolution or God changing or evolving, mm-hmm. There's sort of two heads to it. One is that God certainly is moderating, and I think that's is one of the, I think most, as a Christian, most of us are kind of uncomfortable with the idea of God that destroys Jericho and destroys all of humanity in the flood, and it's mm-hmm. hard to, in some ways it's even hard to seem like it's the same God that we really think about right now. On the other hand, the God of the Old Testament seems so incredibly accessible. He's there, and I think that's the part of the arguing with God or wrestling with God that seems maybe so appealing, at least to me, is the fact that he's right there. You know, he's duking it out with you. You know, and sometimes I think when, you know, I have moments of despair in my faith, I feel like I might be yelling and screaming, but there's nobody yelling back.
Right.
And I guess part of that's the one comment. The other is, I wonder, is there any parallel to that, you know, to that evolution in Jewish thought? I mean, do you still think of God that levels Sodom and Gomorrah, or is there some evolution?
I think that although it's a commonplace to call the God of the Hebrew Bible the God of wrath and the God of punishment and the God of judgment, that's just not anything like a complete reading. And I think generally Jews have looked at the text and really clung fast to the God that interacts with us in a positive way and is merciful and repents and turns away God's wrath. And the God that would turn away God's own wrath is the God I think we probably pay more attention to. Yeah.
Luther found that certainly true. His first block of teaching had to be the Psalms. Mm-hmm. And what he discovered in the Psalms is something he never discovered in the Christian church, which was a living, dynamic God that you can be in relationship with.
Right.
And that transformed the rest of his theology. And I think, so that's the God he discovered in the Old Testament, is the God of Psalms, the God of those prayers, those deep-seated, with the full range of emotion that those prayers have.
Right. And I think that the poetic nature of the Psalms got deeply into the emotional contact.
But that's also so, the Psalms are so incredibly personal.
Yeah.
That's right. I see exactly what you mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
From the Jewish perspective, do you envision that God is in all of us and in all things?
The Jewish perspective? I'm not sure if there's a the Jewish perspective on that.
Spokesperson today?
As the official Jew of Holy Village. I should wear a sign.
Yeah.
How are you based on your perspective?
I think that that we're made in God's image, whatever that quite means. I think it means something. We're made out of God's creation. And in Jewish law and Jewish thought, we treat our bodies as very much something owned by God, belonging to God, that we are stewards of, in traditional thought, and so it's why traditionally suicide would not be allowed in Jewish law, because this is God's body, not ours. So yeah, there's a God present in the stuff of us. Whether that's all, I sometimes think that maybe that's all of God that's present in the world, is the piece of God that's in us. And there's actually one sort of Jewish story approach that says, and it's sort of related to this idea of us gaining our full humanity, that says that the only way for there to be room for us to live our lives and to have choice, the only way that could be was for God to remove God's self from enough of creation to give us room.
So then God didn't create both the good, or even if, from that perspective, God does not create everything?
No, I think that God creates everything in that perspective, but then leaves a big chunk of it alone. If that makes sense.
So God is not in that perspective then?
God is, I'm going to go down a path I might regret if I continue with this. I think that godliness is, in that perspective, godliness and God stuff is present, but God as an active interceding force might not be. If that makes sense.
So when you're wrestling with God, you're not really wrestling. I look at it wrestling with myself. So I think of myself as part of God.
Yeah, well, I think it becomes wrestling with our understanding of what God is in creation and in our lives. Yeah.
I'm wondering if the reason you're asking the question is because the Christian perspective is that God is present in each of us in the Holy Spirit. And that we can minister to each other in a way that God would want to minister to each of us. So if I have a need and I go to a friend and say, I need this, the friend may feel compelled to help me, which would be just like God helping me. Mm-hmm. And I think he's asking if there is a parallel interpretation of...
Well, I think that the parallel interpretation is, what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God? And that's Jewishly, I think, pretty close to what you're saying. And, you know, that was, as I was growing up, part of interpersonal relationships and about social action, and that we're carrying out what God's will or what God wants us to be. Now, God's will is actually another part of our subject here, because if we're challenging God, and if God is going to change God's mind, then all of a sudden, God's will doesn't just become let there be light, fiat lux, yehi, or whichever language you want to do it in, and there is light. God's will is not, God thinks it, and it comes to pass. God's will is God's point of view, you know? God's idea of how things should best unfold. But maybe God doesn't have a full answer, because God doesn't know how people are going to react and how people are going to carry that and what's going to happen with that. I think that, you know, it would take a long time to debate, and I don't want to do it, whether it was a good or a bad thing to rebel or to avoid God in the Garden of Eden. But, you know, you have stories where you see history being created by people in partnership with God, rather than simply by God saying, this is what's going to happen next. Yes, the redemption from slavery is mostly God, but it's also Moses being up to the task. And another piece we just read again in our yearly cycle of reading from the Torah, just read a few weeks ago, the story of the rebellion of Korach in the wilderness, and God's anger also when the spies come back from the promised land and say it's filled with giants, and you know we can't go there; they'll kill us. It'll be terrible. And God is mightily disappointed with this response. But it's the human response of the human beings who are supposed to be carrying out God's plan. And if those human beings can't do it that way, then God's plan has got to be subject to modification. But what's the modification that God makes at that point? None of you will enter the promised land. No one who is part of the generation that left Egypt will enter the land. And so we begin 40 years, 40 pretty much not even recounted years in the Bible, but the 40 years of wandering, so that they will not enter the land. And that's maybe God's recognition of something about human beings that God didn't acknowledge, recognize, foresee. Can I say that God didn't foresee something? But it makes sense when we think about it, when we look back at it. Can a people who were slaves become the foundation of a free land? Maybe in their rebellion and their endless complaints and in their fear and in the divisiveness, they're cluing God into something. We are not the ones who are going to make that land of milk and honey our own. It's going to have to be those who were raised with the idea that they are free, redeemed by God, and capable of doing so. God's plan only unfolds within our capacity to carry it out in this perspective. Okay? That we are the partners in this operation. And we've got to be, just maybe the way we had to leave the garden. So that's sort of what this rebellion idea, what this God wrestling idea leads to, is the idea that we have a role and we have to continue to have a role. Yeah.
One of the pictures I see with that is that the humans have their own ideas as to how they want the plan to be worked out. God has a plan, quote unquote, whatever mm-hmm. that means. Yeah. I don't think it's a blueprint.
Right.
But at times I think that God kind of has to sit with arms crossed and wait till the human does whatever they want to do to get some things out of the system right. or some things to learn. And then it's like, okay, you ready now? Now we can go at this again.
Yeah.
That I guess I wrestle with that God changes his mind to, mm-hmm. okay, I'll let you play it out. Mm-hmm. Take as much rope as you want.
Right.
Do whatever you need to. I'm still here. Then we'll get back on track
right.
again.
Right.
But that is always relational, always relational. Uh-huh. God doesn't turn back and run away and say until, you know, like the parent and the child thing, yeah. they're separated.
And God's response will never again be to wipe out
yeah.
the earth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was just thinking of the story that illustrates that perfectly, which is Elijah, just after his miraculous destruction of all these evil priests, and he runs up into the mountains and wants to die. And God says, no, you better eat because you're going to go on a long journey. So he does, he eats, and then he goes on a long journey and he hides again. And God says, well, what are you doing here? And he says, well, I'm the only righteous person left. I don't know what, they're going to come kill me. And God says, no, you need to go and prophesy for me. So it's exactly what you're describing. God is just kind of, he's helping Elijah along, and then he folds his arms and he waits to see what happens.
Right.
And it doesn't quite come out right, just like with Jonah.
Right.
And then he helps him along again, and he folds his arm again, and eventually it all comes out.
Yeah, right. And that, I think that's a, you know, a sort of parallel, slightly different, but parallel way of looking at some of the same issues in human existence and people's relationship to God.
I guess I just would add one more thing. I think that humans would prefer to blame God for the bad things or for the yucky screw-ups that happen.
Yeah.
I would prefer to blame something else than to look at my own life or to just say, other things happen. You know, I'm caught in this whirlwind of what's going on, and there are sometimes other things that happen. That is,
right.
I can't say that those are God's will.
Right.
They happen. They just happen. But God chose not to intercede.
Yeah.
That's God's choice.
That's right.
It to me is like the Joel saying, okay, do you trust me in this situation or not? It's up to you. Look, I did all of this, but now, still, you gotta decide. Do you trust me or not?
Right.
I'm God.
Yeah.
Or else you're not.
Yeah. Right. And so, you know, we have to be there. Were you raising your hand?
No, I just have the back that's bothering me.
Oh, okay. Well, that's fine. I wish we could do something about your back. I'm reminded of the story, a story that kind of illustrates this idea that we're sort of jointly responsible, we and God. There's a story of Moish, who always buys a lottery, I'm ruining the story. There's Moshe, who always hoped that he would win the lottery, and he really thought, you know, he's a righteous man. He could do good things with the money, and everything would be good, and it sort of, it would be a reward for his righteousness, and week after week he never wins the lottery. And he's terribly frustrated about this. And finally, praise to God, he says, "Dear God, I am a righteous man. And I would do good with this money. If only you would let me win the lottery. It doesn't even have to be a big amount. Just let me win something." And God says, "Moish, you got to meet me halfway. You got to buy a ticket." Yeah, and this is, you know, this is sort of an illustration that the notion that we just wait is not right, and maybe sometimes the notion that we just run off half-cocked and do whatever we want is not right, but somehow forming a partnership works. The one other story I wanted to tell about this is we talk about the sort of the Jewish approach to the relationship with God. One of the things that's arisen over, you know, millennia now is the idea of a certain code of behavior. That in the Orthodox view is very strict and often has to do with things that we don't understand even why it's there, why this commandment is in the Torah, and why we should be doing it. But a strictly observant Jew would follow it. But the truth is, there was a lot of argumentation, even among the rabbis, as these rules were being codified. And one of the interesting stories about this kind of argument going on is that also kind of ties in with what we're talking about today, is the story of the oven of Achnai. And Achnai had an oven that there's a disagreement over whether it was kosher or not. Kosher, whether it was strictly able to be used for particular purposes in preparing food, according to Jewish law. And the rabbis are arguing about this, and all of the rabbis are saying it's kosher, except for Rabbi Eliezer. And Rabbi Eliezer says, "I am certain that this oven is not kosher." "Well, sorry, we disagree." Eliezer says, "If I am right, let the stream flow backward."
and they look, and the stream begins to flow back. Well, that's very interesting, but we all think that the oven is kosher. Eliezer says, if I am right, let the walls of this house shudder. And they begin to just quake and shudder. And it's an amazing, scary event. And still, the other rabbis are unpersuaded. As if I am right, let the voice of God, the Holy One, blessed be He, come down from the sky and say so. Dark clouds that are parting, and then the sun peeking through, and then this deep voice that says, Reb Eliezer is correct. The oven is not kosher. And the other rabbis say, well, that's all well and good, but, you know, we disagree. We're declaring it to be a kosher oven. And Eliezer says, the stream flowed backwards. The walls shook. The voice of God spoke to you, and you're still taking this other point of view. And how could this be? And one of the other rabbis says, because the Torah is no longer in heaven. The Torah is no longer in heaven. It has been given to us according to our heritage, and it is up to us to decide how it's going to be interpreted and what it means. God gave it to us, and now, and God also said in the book of Exodus, after the majority, you must incline. And so, it's no longer God's business. And this is you know, a really different, as I say, many Jews as well as Christians have a hard time wrapping their heads around this idea. But this is a significant strain in Judaism about what our place is in the law, in the relationship to God, in our willingness to argue with each other, and ultimately, as needs be, to argue with God and to wrestle what we call the Bible wrestle. Michael.
Is there, in the Jewish tradition now, from your perspective,
yeah,
is there current revelation that is coming from God?
No. I think the Jewish point of view is that the prophets of the Hebrew Bible are the end of Revelation, and that there was, in addition to the written Torah, a sense of oral Torah instruction, law that was handed down from Sinai through the generations, and to not only the rabbis who created the Mishnah and the Talmud in the beginning of the diaspora after the destruction of the temple in the year 70, but is believed to be that same law handed down today that is ours to sort of interpret and shape, but that revelation does not occur now. Yes?
So I'm interpreting what you're saying is that from the perspective of some parts of the Jewish faith, that the law that man now has from God is higher than God's law, even if it were to be spoken to. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, yeah, that's, it sounds so hubristic when you say it that way. I think that we're saying is that the law as we've given, let's say, used our God-given intelligences to interpret and to make work in our lives is the law that we go by.
So God cannot, so they are above God.
Well, I don't know. I guess I'd say if God convincingly, I wouldn't say it's above God, because the understanding is that they came for God and they came from God, and we don't have any recent communications telling us that our interpretations need to be revised. I don't know what the response would be if we heard the voice from on high now saying, you've got it all wrong. Thankfully, I don't have to deal with that particular issue right now. Did I see another hand go up?
Yes. But in your story that you just told us, the people think they're wiser than God, because he said this is a kosher, this is not a kosher, and they didn't believe God.
No, they didn't. It's not that they didn't believe God. They said, God, you already said that we should decide about stuff like this.
And he provided you, the Jews, with the ability to make the decision. He gave them the tools to make the decisions.
Right.
So it isn't up to God to decide whether something's kosher or not. He decided how to determine what is kosher or not, and it's up to
you. Well, God did, you know, I think discussed yesterday, God only said, don't see the kid in its mother's milk, which the laws of the kosher laws go far beyond that in their intricacy. So they're very, very much human made. Yeah.
Well, I think this is along the lines of what we talked about last time I was in your session, which is the idea of the law and the commandments as a gift. Mm-hmm. And I think this is something that's really difficult when we talk to people who aren't Christians or Jews. I mean, just because people say, well, you're restricted by all these laws and these things that don't make any sense that you have to do. And I sort of, a little chink fell into place when you told the story, which is that I think what my interpretation of what the story is saying is God has given us a gift. He's given us the commandments. I mean, who wouldn't believe the world is not a better place if nobody lied or nobody killed? Right. I mean, it is a gift. And it's up to us to decide what to do with it. Mm-hmm. Whether we decide to use the gift or not to use it is really up to us. And my personal theology is also that we bear not just in terms of eternal damnation, but we bear or suffer the consequences here on earth for refusing the gift.
Right. And that rather than being a stricture, it may be liberating to have the gift. But it's nice to hear you say you have a personal theology, because that's a very Jewish thing to say. I wanted to end, as we have been ending, with a song in Hebrew. This one is maybe not quite as apt as Karen and I have been trying to do for the other ones, but it's apt enough. It's not about wrestling, but it is about fighting, and it does I think lead into the idea of the Jubilee, and it's a text you're all familiar with. It says, "Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they study war anymore." And in Hebrew, it goes like this: Lo yisal goy el goy cherev. Lo yilmadu od milchama, lo yisagoy el goy cherev, lo yilmadu od milchama. It changes. Lo yisagoy el goy cherev, lo yilmadu od milchama, lo yisagoy el goy cherev, lo yilmadu. Sagoy el goy cherev, lo yilmadu milchama, lo yisagoy el goy cherev, lo yilmadu milchama, lo yisagoy el goy cherev, lo yilmadu milchama, lo yisagoy. And sometimes in English we sing, and into plowshares beat their swords, nation shall learn war no more. And into plowshares beat their swords, nation shall learn war no more. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.